stuck out straight behind him. Rolf muttered to himself as he stumped along. Delena's greed destroyed them both. Perella's got no life as a deer. No mate, no young. When she dies, she'll just stop. And Delena with her. Delena couldn't accept death as a woman, but she won't accept life as a deer either. When the bucks call, she won't let Perella answer them. She probably thinks she's being faithful to her husband or some such nonsense. When Perella dies and Delena with her, what will either of them have gained, save a few years of existence that neither of them could call complete? I could not argue with him. The wrongness I had sensed still crawled along my spine. Yet, I struggled to make myself admit this to the fool. Yet, privately I wondered if any save those two could fully understand the decision that had been made. If, perhaps, despite how it appeared to us, it felt right to them. I paused for a time in my telling. The story of those two always disturbed me. If Barak had not been able to call me back from the wolf and into my own body, would we have become as they did? If the fool had not been nearby today, would Night Eyes and I dwell in one body, even now? I did not speak the thought aloud. I knew the fool would have already made that leap. I cleared my throat. Rolf taught us a great deal in the year we were there. But even as we learned the techniques of the magic we shared, Night Eyes and I stopped short of accepting all the customs of the old blood folk. The secrets we learned, I felt we had a right to, simply by virtue of what we were. But I did not feel bound to accept the rules Rolf attempted to impose on us. Perhaps I would have been wiser to dissemble. But I was tired to death of deception, and the layers of lies that must be woven to protect it. So I held myself back from that world, and Night Eyes consented to be held back with me. So it was that we observed their community, but never engaged fully in the lives of the old blood folk. And Night Eyes, too, held back from them. The fool's question was gentle. I tried not to think that there might be a hidden rebuke in it, a questioning as to whether I was the one who had held him back for my own selfish reasons. He felt as I did. The knowledge of the magic that is in us by our blood, this was something they owed to us. And when Rolf dangled it over us as a reward to be given only when we accepted the yoke of his rules, well, that is a form of exclusion, my friend. I glanced over at the grey wolf curled in my blankets. He slept deeply, paying the price of my interference with his body. Did no one extend a simple friend's hand to you there? The fool's question drew me back to my story. I considered it. Holly tried to. I think she pitied me. She was shy and solitary by nature. It was something we had in common. Sleet and his mate had a nest in a great tree on the hillside above Rolf's house, and Holly herself was wont to spend hours perched on a woven platform not far below Sleet's nest. She was never talkative to me, but showed me many small kindnesses, including the gift of a feather bed, a side product of Sleet's skills. I smiled to myself. And she taught me the many skills of living on my own, all I had never learned whilst I lived at Buckkeep Castle and others saw to my needs. There is a genuine pleasure to making leavened bread, and she taught me to cook beyond Burrick's travelling stews and porridges. I was ragged and worn when I first arrived there. She demanded all my clothes, not to mend, but to teach me the proper care of them. I sat by her fire and learned to darn socks without lumping them, how to turn the hems on cuffs before they frayed hopelessly. I shook my head, smiling at the memories. And no doubt Rolf was pleased to see your heads bent together so closely and so often. The fool's tone asked the other question. Had I given Rolf reason to be jealous and spiteful? I drank the last of the lukewarm elf bark tea and leaned back in my chair. The familiar melancholy of the herb was stealing over me. It was never like that, fool. You can laugh if you wish, but it was more like finding a mother. Not that she was that much older than I, but the gentleness and acceptance and the wishing me well, but I cleared my throat. You are right. Rolf was jealous, though he never put it into words. He would come in from the cold to find Nighteyes sprawled on his hearth, and my hands full of yarn from some project of Holly's needles, and he would immediately find some other task that she must do for him. Not that he treated her badly, but he took pains to make it clear she was his woman. Holly never spoke of it to me, but in a way, I think she did it for the purpose to remind him that however many years they had been together, she still had a life and a will of her own. Not that she ever tried to raise the pitch of his jealousy. In fact, before the winter was over, she had made efforts to bring me into the old blood community. At Holly's invitation, friends came to call, and she took great pains to introduce me to all of them. Several families had marriageable daughters, and these ones seemed to visit most often, when I, too, was invited to share a meal with Rolf and Holly. Rolf drank and laughed and became expansive when guests called, and his enjoyment of these occasions was evident. He often observed aloud that this was the merriest winter he could recall in many a year, from which I deduced that Holly did not often open her home to so many guests. Yet she never made her efforts to find me a companion too painfully evident. It was obvious that she considered Twinette my best match. She was a woman but a few years older than me, tall and dark-haired, with deep blue eyes. Her companion beast was a crow, as merry and mischievous as she was. We became friends, but my heart was not ready for anything more than that. I think her father more resented my lack of ardour than Twinette did, for he made several ponderous comments to the effect that a woman would not wait forever. Twinette, I sensed, was not as interested in finding a mate as her parents supposed. We remained friends throughout the spring and into summer. Ollie, Twinette's father, gossiping to Rolf, precipitated my departure from the old blood community at Crow's Neck. He had told his daughter that she must either stop seeing me or press me to declare my intent. In response, Twinette had strongly expressed her own intent, which was not to marry anyone who did not suit her, let alone a man so much younger than myself, both in years and heart. For the sake of making grandchildren, you'd have me bed with someone raised among the unblooded and carrying the taint of Farseer blood. Her words were carried back to me, not by Rolf, but by Holly. She spoke them softly to me, her eyes downcast, as if shamed to utter such rumour. But when she looked up at me, so calmly and gently waiting for my denial, my ready lies died on my lips. I thanked her quietly for making me privy to Twinette's feelings about me, and told her that she had given me much to ponder. Rolf was not there. I'd come to their home to borrow his splitting maul, for summer is the time to make ready winter firewood. I left without asking for the loan of it, for both Nighteyes and I immediately knew that we would not be wintering amongst the old blood. By the time the moon appeared, the wolf and I had once more left Buck Duchy behind us. I hoped that our abrupt departure would be seen as a man's reaction to a courtship gone bad, rather than the bastard fleeing those who had recognized him. Silence fell. I think the fool knew that I had spoken aloud to him my most lingering fear. The old blood had knowledge of my identity, of my name, and that gave them power over me. What I would never admit to Starling, I explained plainly to the fool. Such power over a man should not reside with those who do not love him. Yet they had it, and there was nothing I could do about it. I lived alone and apart from the old blood folk, but not a moment passed for me that I was not distantly aware of my vulnerability to them. I thought of telling him Starling's story of the minstrel at Springfest. Later, I promised myself, later. It was as if I wished to hide danger from myself. I felt suddenly morose and sour. I glanced up to find the fool's eyes on my face. "It's the elf bark," he said quietly. "Elf bark," I conceded irritably, but could not convince myself that the hopelessness that swept through me was completely the after-effect of the drug. Did not at least some of it stem from the pointlessness of my own life? The fool got up and paced the room restlessly. He went from door to hearth to window twice, and then diverted to the cupboard. He brought the brandy and two cups back to the table. It seemed as good an idea as any. I watched him pour. I know we drank that evening, and well into the night the fool took over the talking. I think he tried to be amusing and lighten my mood, but his own spirit seemed as damped as mine. From anecdotes of the Bingtown traders, he launched into a wild tale of sea serpents that entered cocoons to emerge as dragons. When I demanded to know why I'd not seen any of these dragons, he shook his head. "Stunted," he said sadly. They emerged in the late spring, weak and thin, like kittens born too soon. They may yet grow to greatness, but now the poor creatures feel shamed at their frailty. They cannot even hunt for themselves. I well recall his look of wide-eyed guilt, his golden eyes bored into me. "Could it be my fault?" he asked softly, senselessly at the end of his tale. "Did I attach myself to the wrong person?" Then he filled his glass again and drank it down with a purposefulness that reminded me of Burrick in one of his black moods. I don't remember going to bed that night, but I do recall lying there, my arm flung across the sleeping wolf, drowsily watching the fool. He had taken out a funny little instrument that had but three strings. He sat before the fire and strummed it, plucking discordant notes that he smoothed with the words of a sad song, in a language I had never heard. I set my fingers to my own wrist. In the darkness I could feel him there. He did not turn to look at me, but awareness prickled between us. His voice seemed to grow truer in my ears, and I knew he sang the song of an exile longing for his homeland. Chapter 9. Dead Man's Regrets. The skill is often said to be the hereditary magic of the Farseer line, and certainly it seems to flow most predictably in those bloodlines. It is not unknown, however, for the skill to crop up as a latent talent almost anywhere in the six duchies. In earlier reigns it was customary for the skill master who served the Farseer monarch at Buckkeep regularly to seek out youngsters who showed potential for the skill. They were brought to Buckkeep, instructed in the skill if they showed strong talent, and encouraged to form coteries, mutually chosen groups of six that aided the reigning monarch as required. Although there is a great dearth of information on these coteries, almost as if scrolls relating to them were deliberately destroyed, oral tradition indicates that there were seldom more than two or three coteries in existence at any time, and that strong skill users have always been rare. The procedure skill masters used for locating children with latent talent is lost to time. King Bounty, father to King Shrewd, discontinued the practice of building coteries, perhaps believing the restricting knowledge of the skill to the exclusive use of princes and princesses would increase the power of those who did possess it. Thus it was that when war came to the shores of the six duchies in the reign of King Shrewd, there were no skill coteries to aid the Farseer reign in the defence of the kingdom. I awoke in the night with a jolt. Malta. I had left the fool's mare picketed out on the hillside. The pony would come in and likely have even put herself within the barn, but I had left the horse out there all day and with no water. There was only one thing to do about it. I arose silently and left the cabin, not closing the door behind me lest the shut of it awaken the fool. Even the wolf I left sleeping as I walked out into the dark alone. I stopped briefly at the barn. As I suspected, the pony had come in. I touched her gently with my wit sense. She was sleeping, and I left her where she was. I climbed the hill to where I had picketed the horse, glad that I was not walking in the true dark of a winter night. The stars and the full moon seemed very close. Even so, my familiarity with my path guided me more than my eyes. As I came up on Malta, the horse gave a rebuking snort. I untied her picket line and led her down the hill. When the stream cut our path on its way to the sea, I stopped and let her drink. It was a beautiful summer night. The air was mild, the chirring of night insects filled the air, accompanied by the sound of the horse sucking water. I let my gaze wander, filling myself with the night. Dark stole the colours of the grass and trees, but somehow their stark shades of black and grey made the landscape seem more intricate. The moisture in the cooler air awoke all the summer scents that had dozed by day. I opened my mouth and drew in a deep breath, tasting the night more fully. I gave myself up to my senses, letting go of my human cares, taking this moment of now and letting it stretch eternally around me. My wit unfurled around me, and I became one with the night's splendour. There is a natural euphoria to the wit. It is both like and unlike the skill. With the wit, one is aware of all the life that surrounds one. It was not just the warmth of the mare nearby me that I sensed. I knew the scintillant forms of the myriad insects that populated the grasses, and felt even the shadowy life force of the great oak that lifted its limbs between the moon and me. Just up the hillside, a rabbit crouched motionless in the summer grasses. I felt its indistinct presence not as a piece of life located in a certain place, but as one sometimes hears a single voice's note within a market's roar. But above all, I felt a physical kinship with all that lived in the world. I had a right to be here. I was as much a part of this summer night as the insects or the water purling past my feet. I think that old magic draws much of its strength from that acknowledgement, that we are a part of that world, no more, but certainly no less than the rabbit. That rightness of unity washed through me, laving away the nastiness of the skill greed that had earlier befouled my soul. I took a deeper breath, and then breathed it out as if it were my last, willing myself to be part of this good, clean night. My vision wavered, doubled, and then cleared. For a pent breath of time, I was not myself, was not on the summer hillside near my cabin, and I was not alone. I was a boy again. Escaped from confining stone walls and tangling bedclothes, I ran lightshod through a sheep pasture dotted with tufts of ungrazed weeds, trying vainly to keep up with my companion. She was as beautiful as the star-dotted night, her tawny coat spangled with darkness. She moved as unobtrusively as night herself did. I followed her, not with human eyes, but with the wit bond that joined us. I was drunk with love of her and love of this night, intoxicated with the heady rush of this wild freedom. I knew I had to go back before the sun rose. She knew just as strongly that we did not, that there was no better time than now to make our escape. And in my next breath, that knowing was gone. The night still bloomed and beckoned around me, but I was a grown man, not a boy lost in the wonder of his first wit bond. I did not know who my senses had brushed or where they were, nor why we had meshed our awarenesses so completely. I wondered if he had been as cognizant of me as I was of him. It did not matter. Wherever they were, whoever they were, I wished them well in their night's hunting. I hoped their bond would last long and be deep as their bones. I felt a questioning tug at the lead rope. Malta had quenched her thirst and had no wish to stand still while the insects feasted on her. I became aware that my own warm body had attracted a swarm of little bloodsuckers as well. She swished her tail and I waved my hand about my head before we set off down the hill once more. I stabled her and slipped softly back into the cabin to seek out my own bed for the rest of the night. Night eyes had stretched out, leaving me less than half the bed, but I did not mind. I stretched out beside him and set my hand lightly on his ribs. The beating of his heart and the movement of his breath were more soothing than any lullaby. As I closed my eyes, I felt more at peace than I had in weeks. I awoke easily and early the next morning. My interlude on the hillside seemed to have rested me more than sleep. The wolf had not fared so well. He still slept heavily, a healing sleep. I felt a twinge of conscience over that, but pushed it aside. Whatever I had done to his heart seemed to tax the resources of the rest of his body, but surely that was better than letting him die. I surrendered the bed to him, and left him sleeping. The fool was not about, but the door was left standing open, a fair indication that he had gone out. I set a small fire, put on the kettle, and then took some time with washing up and shaving. I had just smoothed my hair back behind my ears when I heard the fool's footsteps on the porch. He entered with a basket of eggs on his arm. When I looked up from drying my face, he stopped in his tracks. A wide grin spread slowly over his face. "Why, it's Fitz. A bit older, a bit more worn, but Fitz all the same. I had wondered what you looked like under that thatch." I glanced back into the mirror. "I suppose I don't take much pains with my appearance any more," I grimaced at myself, then dabbed at a spot of blood. As usual, I had nicked myself where the old scar from my time in Buckkeep's dungeon seamed my face. Thank you, Regal. Starling told me that I look far older than my years, that I could return to Buckkeep Town and never fear that anyone would recognize me. The fool made a small sound of disgust as he set the eggs on the table. "Starling is, as usual, wrong on both counts. For the number of years and lives you have lived, you look remarkably young. It's true that experience and time have changed your features. Folk recalling the boy Fitz would not see him grown to a man in you. Yet some of us, my friend, would recognize you even if you were flayed and set afire." Now there's a comforting thought. I set the mirror down and turned to the task of making breakfast. "Your colour has changed," I observed a moment later as I broke eggs into a bowl, "but you yourself don't look a day older than the last time I saw you." The fool was filling the teapot with steaming water. "It's the way of my kind," he said quietly. "Our lives are longer, so we progress through them more slowly. I've changed, Fitz, even if all you see is the colour of my flesh. When last you saw me, I was just approaching adulthood. All sorts of new feelings and ideas were blossoming in me, so many that I scarce could keep my mind on the tasks at hand. When I recall how I behaved, well, even I am scandalized. Now I assure you I am far more mature. I know that there is a time and a place for everything, and that what I am destined to do must take full precedent over anything I might long to do for myself." I poured the beaten eggs into a pan and set them at the fire's edge. I spoke slowly. "When you speak in riddles, it exasperates me. Yet when you try to speak clearly of yourself, it frightens me." "All the more reason why I should not speak of myself at all," he exclaimed with false heartiness. "Now, what be our tasks for the day?" I thought it out as I stirred the setting eggs and pushed them closer to the fire. "I don't know," I said quietly. He looked startled at the sudden change in my voice. "Fitz, are you all right?" I myself could not explain the sudden lurch in my spirits. Suddenly, it all seemed so pointless. When I knew Hap was going to be here for the winter, I always took care to provide for us both. My garden was a quarter that size when the boy first came to me, and Night Eyes and I hunted day to day for our meat. If we did not hunt well and went empty for a day or so, it did not seem of much consequence. Now, I look at all I have already set by and think, if the boy is not here, if Hap is wintering with a master while he starts to learn his trade, why, then I already have plenty for both Night Eyes and me. Sometimes it seems that there's no point to it. And then I wonder if there's any point left to my life at all. A frown divided the fool's brows. "How melancholy you sound. Or is this the elf bark I'm hearing?" "No." I took up the shirred eggs and brought them to the table. It was almost a relief to speak the thoughts I'd been denying. I think it was why Starling brought Hap to me. I think she saw how aimless my life had become, and brought me someone to give shape to my days. The fool set down plates with a clatter and dished food onto them in disgusted splats. "I think you give her credit for thinking of something beyond her own needs. I suspect she picked up the boy on an impulse and dumped him here when she wearied of him. It was just lucky for both of you that you helped each other." I said nothing. His vehemence in his dislike for Starling surprised me. I sat down at the table and began eating. But he had not finished. "If Starling meant for anyone to give shape to your days, it was herself. I doubt that she ever imagined you might need anyone's companionship other than hers." I had an uncomfortable suspicion he was right, especially when I recalled how she had spoken of Night Eyes and Hap on her last visit. "Well, what she thought or didn't think scarcely matters now. One way or another, I'm determined to see Hap apprenticed well, but once you do, you'll be free to take up your own life again. I've a feeling it will call you back to Buckkeep." "You've a feeling?" I asked him dryly. "Is this a fool's feeling or a white prophet's feeling? As you never seem to give credence to any of my prophecies, why should you care?" He smiled archly at me and began eating his eggs. "A time or three, it did seem as if what you predicted came true. Though your predictions were always so nebulous, it seemed to me that you could make them mean anything." He swallowed. "It was not my prophecies that were nebulous, but your understanding of them. When I arrived, I warned you that I had come back into your life because I must, not because I wanted to. Not that I didn't want to see you again, I mean, only that if I could spare you somehow from all we must do, I would." "And what is it, exactly, that we must do?" "Exactly?" he queried, with a raised eyebrow. Exactly and precisely, I challenged him. Oh, very well, then. Exactly and precisely what we must do, we must save the world, you and I. Again. He leaned back, tipping his chair onto its back legs. His pale brows shot towards his hairline as he widened his eyes at me. I lowered my brow into my hands, but he was grinning like a maniac and I could not contain my own smile. Again. I don't recall that we did it the first time.
Of course we did. You're alive, aren't you?
And there is an heir to the Farseer throne. Hence, we change the course of all time. In the rutted path of fate, you were a rock, my dear Fitz, and you have shifted the grinding wheel out of its trough and into a new track. Now, of course, we must see that it remains there. That may be the most difficult part of all. And what exactly, and precisely, must we do to ensure that? I knew his words were bait for mockery, but as ever, I could not resist the question.
It's quite simple. He ate a bite of eggs, enjoying my suspense. Very simple, really.
He pushed the eggs around on his plate, scooped up a bite, and then set his spoon down. He looked up at me, and his smile faded. When he spoke, his voice was solemn. I must see that you survive. Again. You must see that the Farseer heir inherits the throne. And the thought of my survival makes you sad? I demanded in perplexity.
Oh, no, never that.
The thought of what you must go through to survive fills me with foreboding. I pushed my plate away. My appetite fled.
I still don't understand you, I replied irritably.
Yes, you do, he contradicted me implacably. I suppose you say you don't because it's easier that way for both of us. But this time, my friend, I will lay it cold before you. Think back on the last time we were together. Were there not times when death would have been easier and less painful than life?
His words were shards of ice in my belly, but I am nothing if not stubborn.
Well, and when is that ever not true? I demanded of him. There have been very few times in my life when I've been able to shock the fool into silence. That was one of them. He stared at me, his strange eyes getting wider and wider. Then a grin broke over his face. He stood so suddenly he nearly overset his chair, and then lunged at me to seize me in a wild hug. He drew a deep breath as if something that had constricted him had suddenly sprung free.
"Of course, that is true,"
he whispered by my ear. And then, in a shout that near deafened me,
"Of course it is!"
Before I could shrug free of his strangling embrace, he sprang apart from me. He cut a caper that made motley of his ordinary clothes, and then sprang lightly to my tabletop. He flung his arms wide as if he once more performed for all of King Shrewd's court rather than an audience of one.
"Death is always less painful and easier than life. You speak true, and yet we do not, day to day, choose death, because ultimately death is not the opposite of life, but the opposite of choice. Death is what you get when there are no choices left to make. Am I right?"
Infectious as his fey mood was, I still managed to shake my head. "I have no idea if you are right or wrong."
"Then take my word for it. I am right. For am I not the White Prophet? And are you not my catalyst who comes to change the course of all time? Look at you. Not the hero, no. The changer. The one who, by his existence, enables others to be heroes. Ah, Fitz, Fitz, we are who we are, and who we ever must be. And when I am discouraged, when I lose heart to the point of saying, 'But why cannot I leave him here, to find what peace he may?' then lo, and behold, you speak with the voice of the catalyst, and change my perception of all that I do, and enable me to be once more what I must be. The White Prophet."
I sat, looking up at him. Despite my efforts, a smile twisted my mouth. I thought I enabled other people to be heroes, not prophets.
"Ah, well,"
he leapt lightly to the floor. "Some of us must be both, I fear." He gave himself a shake and tugged his jerkin straight. Some of the wildness went out of him.
"So,
To return to my original question, what are our tasks today? My turn to give you the answer. Our first task today is to give no thought to the morrow. I took his advice, for that day at least. I did things I had not been giving myself permission to do, for they were not the serious tasks that provided against the morrow, but the simple work that brought me pleasure. I worked on my inks, not to take to market and sell for coin, but to try to create a true purple for my own pleasure. It yielded no success that day. All my purples turned to brown as they dried, but it was a work I enjoyed. As for the fool, he amused himself by carving on my furniture. I glanced up at the sound of my kitchen knife scraping across wood. The movement caught his eye.
Sorry,
he apologized at once. He held the knife up between two fingers to show me, and then carefully set it down. He got up from his chair and wandered over to his saddle pack. After a moment of digging, he tugged out a roll of fine bladed tools. Humming to himself, he went back to the table and set to on the chairs. He went bare-fingered to his task, tugging off the fine glove that usually masked his skill hand. As the day progressed, my simple chairs gained leafy vines twining up their backs and occasional little faces peeping out of the foliage. When I looked up from my work in mid-afternoon, I saw him come in with chunks of seasoned wood from my woodpile. I leaned back from my desk to watch him as he turned and considered each one, studying them and tracing their grain with his skill fingers, as if he could read their secrets hidden from my eyes. At length, he selected one with a knee in it and started in on it. He hummed to himself as he worked, and I left him to it. Night Eyes woke once during the day. He clumped down from my bed with a sigh and tottered outside. I offered him food when he returned, but he turned his nose up at it. He had drunk deeply all the water he could hold, and he lay himself down with a sigh on the cool floor of the cabin. He slept again, but not as deeply. And so I passed that day in pleasure, which is to say, in the sort of work I wanted to do, rather than the work that I thought I ought to be doing. Chade came often to my mind that day. I wondered, as I seldom had before, at how the old assassin had passed his long hours and days up in his isolated tower before I had come to be his apprentice. Then I sniffed disdainfully at that image of him. Long before I had arrived, Chade had been the royal assassin, bearing the king's justice in the form of quiet work wherever it needed to go. The sizable library of scrolls in his apartments and his endless experiments with poisons and deadly artifice were proof that he had known how to occupy his days, and he had had the welfare of the Farseer Rain to give him a purpose in life. Once I, too, had shared that purpose. I had shrugged free of it to have a life of my own. Odd that in the process I had somehow wrenched myself free of the very life I had thought to have to myself. To gain the freedom to enjoy my life, I had severed all connections with that old life. I had lost contact with all who had loved me and all I had loved. That wasn't the complete truth, but it suited my mood. An instant later I realized I was wallowing in self-pity. My last three attempts at a purple ink were drying to brown, though one did have a very nice shade of rose to the brown. I set aside that scrap of paper, after making notes on it as to how I had got the colour. It would be a good ink for botanical illustrations, I thought. I unfolded my legs from my chair and rose, stretching. The fool looked up from his work. "Hungry?" I asked him. He considered a moment. "I could eat. Let me cook. The food you make fills the stomach, but does little more than that." He set aside the figurine he was working on. He saw me glance at it and covered it almost jealously. "When I'm finished," he promised, and began a purposeful ransacking of my cupboards. While he was tutting over my lack of any interesting spices, I wandered outside. I crossed the stream which could have led me gently down to the beach. Idly I walked up the hill, past both horse and pony grazing freely. At the crest of the hill, I walked more slowly until I reached my bench. I sat down on it. Only a few steps away, the grassy hill gave way to sudden slate cliffs and the rocky beach below them. Seated on my bench, all I could see was the wide vista of ocean spread out before me. Restlessness walked through my bones again. I thought of my dream of the boy and the hunting cat out in the night and smiled to myself. "Run away from it all," the cat had urged the boy, and the thought had all my sympathy. Yet years ago that was what I had done, and this was what it had brought me. A life of peace and self-sufficiency, a life that should have satisfied me, yet here I sat. A time later the fool joined me. Night-Eyes too came at his heels to lie down at my feet with a martyred sigh. "Is it the skill hunger?" the fool asked with quiet sympathy. "No," I replied, and almost laughed. The hunger he had unknowingly waked in me yesterday was temporarily crippled by the elf bark I had consumed. I might long to skill, but right now my mind was numbed to that ability. "I've put dinner to cook slow over a little fire, to keep from driving us out of the house. We've plenty of time." He paused, and then asked carefully, "And after you left the old blood folk, where did you go?" I sighed. The wolf was right. Talking to the fool did help me to think, but perhaps he made me think too much. I looked back through the years and gathered up the threads of my tale. "Everywhere. When we left there, we had no destination, so we wandered." I stared out across the water. "For 4 years we wandered, all through the 6 duchies. I've seen Tilth in winter, when snow but a few inches deep blows across the wide plains, but the cold seems to go down to the earth's very bones. I crossed all of Farrow to reach Ripon, and then walked on to the coast. Sometimes I took work as a man and bought bread, and sometimes the two of us hunted as wolves and ate our meat dripping." I glanced over at the fool. He listened, his golden eyes intent on my story. If he judged me, his face gave no sign of it. "When we reached the coast, we took a ship north. Although Night-Eyes did not enjoy it, I visited Bairn's duchy in the depth of one winter."
"Bairn's?"
He considered that.
"Once you were promised to Lady Celerity of Bairn's duchy."
The question was in his face, but not in his voice. "That was not of my will, as you recall. I did not go there to seek out Celerity, but I did glimpse Lady Faith, Duchess of Bairns, as she rode through the streets on her way to Ripplekeep Castle. She did not see me, and if she had, I'm sure she would not have recognized the ragged wanderer as Lord Fitz Chivalry. I hear that Celerity married rich, in both love and lands, and is now the Lady of Ice Towers near Icetown."
"I am glad for her," the fool said gravely.
"And I never loved her, but I admired her spirit, and liked her well enough. I'm glad of her good fortune."
"And then?"
"I went to the Near Islands. From there I wished to make the long crossing to the Out Islands, to see for myself the land of the folk who had raided and made us miserable for so long. But the wolf refused to even consider such a long sea journey. So we returned to the mainland and travelled south. We went mostly by foot, though we took ship past Buckkeep and did not pause there. We journeyed down the coast of Ripon and Shokes, and on beyond the 6 duchies. I didn't like Chalced. We took ship from there just to get away from it."
"How far did you go?"
the fool prompted when I fell silent. I felt my mouth twist in a grin as I bragged, "All the way to Bingtown."
"Did you?"
his interest heightened.
"And what did you think of it?"
"Lively. Prosperous. It put me in mind of Tradeford, the elegant people in their ornate houses with glass in every window. They sell books in street booths there, and in one street of their market every shop has its own sort of magic. Just to walk down that way dizzied me. I could not tell you what kind of magic it was, but it pressed against my senses, giddying me like too strong perfume. I shook my head. I felt like a backward foreigner, and no doubt so they thought me, in my rough clothes with a wolf at my side. Yet despite all I saw there, the city couldn't live up to the legend. What did we used to say? That if a man could imagine a thing, he could find it for sale in Bingtown. Well, I saw much there that was far beyond my imagining, but that didn't mean it was something I'd want to buy. I saw great ugliness there, too. Slaves coming off a ship, with great cankers on their ankles from the chains. We saw one of their talking ships, too. I had always thought them just a tale. I grew silent for a moment, wondering how to convey what Night-Eyes and I had sensed about that grim magic.
"It wasn't a magic I'd ever be comfortable around," I said at last.
The sheer humanity of the city had overwhelmed the wolf, and he was happy to leave as soon as I suggested it. I felt smaller after my visit there. I appreciated anew the wildness and isolation of Buck's Coast, and the rough militancy of Buckkeep. I had once thought Buckkeep the heart of all civilization, but in Bingtown they spoke of us as barbaric and rude. The comments I overheard stung, yet I could not deny them. I left Bingtown a humbled man, resolved to add to my education and better discover the true width of the world. I shook my head at that recollection. Had I ever lived up to my resolve? We didn't have the money for ship passage, even if Night Eyes could have faced it. We decided to journey up the coast on foot. The fool turned an incredulous face to me.
But you can't do that.
That's what everyone warned us. I thought it was city talk, a warning from folk who had never travelled hard and rough. But they were right. Against all counsel, we attempted to travel by foot up the coastline. In the wild lands outside of Bingtown, we found strangeness that near surpassed what we had discovered beyond the mountain kingdom. Well is that coast called the Cursed Shores. I was tormented by half-formed dreams, and sometimes my wakened imaginings were giddy and threatening. It distressed the wolf that I walked on the edges of madness. I can offer no reason for this. I suffered no fevers, nor any of the other symptoms of the illnesses that can unseat a man's mind, yet I was not myself as we passed through that rough and inhospitable country. Vivid dreams of Verity and our dragons came back to haunt me. Even awake, I tormented myself endlessly with the foolishness of past decisions, and thought often of ending my own life. Only the companionship of the wolf kept me from such an act. Looking back, I recall not days and nights, but a succession of lucid and disturbing dreams. Not since I had first travelled on the Skill Road had I suffered such a contortion of my own thoughts. It is not an experience I would willingly repeat. Never, before or since, had I seen a stretch of coast as devoid of humanity. Even the animals that lived there rang sharp and odd against my wit sense. The physical aspects of this coast were as foreign to us as the savour of it. There were bogs that steamed and stank and burned our nostrils, and lush marshes where all the plant life seemed twisted and deformed despite its rank and luxuriant growth. We reached the Rain River, which the folk of Bingtown called the Rain Wild River. I cannot say what distorted whim persuaded me to follow it inland, but I attempted it. The swampy shores, rank growth, and strange dreams of the place soon turned us back. Something in the soil ate at Night Eye's pads and weakened the tough leather boots I wore until they were little more than tatters. We admitted ourselves defeated, but then added a greater error to our wayward quest when we cut young trees to fashion a raft. Night Eye's nose had warned us against drinking any of the river water, but I had not fully appreciated what a danger it presented to us. Our makeshift raft barely lasted to carry us back to the mouth of the river, and we both incurred ulcerating sores from the touch of the water. We were relieved to get back to good, honest, salt water. Despite the sting of it, it proved most healing to our sores. Although Chalced has long claimed rightful domain of the land up to the Rain River, and has frequently asserted that Bingtown too lies within its reign, we saw no signs of any settlements on that coast. Night Eyes and I travelled a long and inhospitable way north. 3 days past the Rain River, we seemed to leave the strangeness behind, but we journeyed another 10 days before we encountered a human settlement. By then, regular washing in brine had healed much of our sores, and my thoughts seemed more my own, but we presented the aspect of a weary beggar and his mangy dog. Folk were not welcoming to us. My footsore journey north through Chalced persuaded me that folk there are the most inimical in the world. I enjoyed Chalced fully as much as Burwick had led me to believe I would. Even their magnificent cities could not move me. The wonders of its architecture and the heights of its civilization are built on a foundation of human misery. The reality of widespread slavery appalled me. I paused in my tale to glance at the freedom earring that hung from the fool's ear. It had been Burwick's grandmother's hard-won prize, the mark of a slave who had won freedom. The fool lifted a hand to touch it with a finger. It hung next to several others carved of wood, and its silver network caught the eye. "Burwick," the fool said quietly. "And Molly, I ask you directly this time, did you ever seek them out?" I hung my head for a moment. "Yes," I admitted after a time. "I did. It is odd you should ask now, for it was as I crossed Chalced that I was suddenly seized with the urge to see them. One evening, as we camped well away from the road, I felt my sleep seized by a powerful dream. Perhaps the images came to me because in some corner of her heart Molly kept still a place for me. Yet I did not dream of Molly as a lover dreams of his beloved. I dreamed of myself, I thought, small and hot and deathly ill. It was a black dream, a dream of all sensations without images. I lay curled tight against Burrick's chest, and his presence and smell were the only comforts I knew in my misery. Then unbearably cool hands touched my fevered skin. They tried to lift me away, but I wriggled and cried out, clinging to him. Burrick's strong arm closed around me again. "Leave her be," he commanded hoarsely. I heard Molly's voice from a distance, wavering and distorted.
"Burrick, you're as sick as she is. You can't take care of her. Let me have her while you rest."
"No. Leave her beside me. You take care of Shivan yourself."
"Your son is fine. Neither of us is ill. Only you and Nettle. Let me take her, Burrick."
"No,"
he groaned. His hand settled on me protectively.
"This is how the blood plague began when I was a boy. It killed everyone I loved. Molly, I couldn't bear it if you took her away from me and she died. Please, leave her beside me."
"So you can die together?"
she demanded, her weary voice going shrill. There was terrible resignation in his voice.
"If we must. Death is colder when it finds you alone, and I will hold her to the last."
He was not rational, and I felt both Molly's anger and her fear for him. She brought him water, and I fussed when she half sat him up to drink it. I tried to drink from the cup she held to my mouth, but my lips were cracked and sore, my head hurt too badly, and the light was too bright. When I pushed it away, the water slopped on my chest, icy cold, and I shrieked and began to wail.
"Nettle, Nettle, hush," she bade me.
But her hands were cold when she touched me. I wanted nothing of my mother just then, and knew an echo of Nettle's jealousy that another child claimed the throne of Molly's lap now. I clutched at Burrick's shirt, and he held me close again and hummed softly in his deep voice. I pushed my face against him where the light could not touch my eyes and tried to sleep. I tried so desperately to sleep that I pushed myself into wakefulness. I opened my eyes to my breath rasping in and out of my lungs. Sweat cloaked me, but I could not forget the tightness of my hot, dry skin in the skill dream. I had wrapped my cloak about me when I lay down to sleep. Now I fought clear of its confines. We had chosen to sleep away the deep of the night on a creek bank. I staggered to the water and drank deeply. When I lifted my face from the water, I found the wolf sitting very straight and watching me, his tail neatly wrapped all four of his feet. He already knew I had to go to them. We set out that night.
"And you knew where to go to find them?"
I shook my head. "No. I knew nothing other than when they first left Buckkeep, they had settled near a town called Capelin Beach, and I knew the feel of where they lived then. With no more than that, we set out. After years of wandering, it was odd to have a destination, and especially to hurry towards it. I did not think about what we did, or how foolish it was. A part of me admitted it was senseless. We were too far away. I'd never get there in time. By the time I arrived, they would be either dead or recovered. Yet having begun that journey, I could not deviate from it. After years of fleeing any who might recognize me, I was suddenly willing to hurl myself back into their lives again? I refused to consider any of it. I simply went." The fool nodded sympathetically at my account. I feared he guessed far more than I willingly told him. After years of denying and refusing the lures of the skill, I immersed myself in it. The addiction clutched at me, and I embraced it in return. It was disconcerting to have it come back upon me with such force, but I did not fight it. Despite the blinding headaches that still followed my efforts, I reached towards Molly and Burrick almost every evening. The results were not encouraging. There is nothing like the heady rush of two skill-trained minds meeting, but skill-seeing is another matter entirely. I had never been instructed in that application of the skill. I had only the knowledge I had gained by groping. My father had sealed off Burrick to the skill, lest anyone try to use his friend against him. Molly had no aptitude for it that I knew. In skill-seeing them, there could be no true connection of minds, but only the frustration of watching them, unable to make them aware of me. I soon found that I could not achieve even that reliably. Disused, my abilities had rusted. Even a short effort left me exhausted and debilitated by pain. And yet I could not resist trying. I strove for those brief connections and mined them for information. A glimpse of hills behind their home, a smell of the sea, black-faced sheep pastured on a distant hill. I treasured every hint of their surroundings and hoped they would be enough to guide me to them. I could not control my seeing. Often I found myself watching the homeliest of tasks, the daily labor of a tub of laundry to be washed and hung, herbs to be harvested and dried, and, yes, beehives to tend. Glimpses of a baby Molly called Shiv, whose face reflected Burrick's features, cut me with both jealousy and wonder. Eventually, I found a village called Capelin Beach. I found the deserted cottage where my daughter had been born. Other folk had lived here since then. No recognizable trace of them remained to my eyes, but the wolf's nose was keener. Nevertheless, Molly and Burrick were long gone from there, and I knew not where. I dared not ask direct questions in the village, for I did not want anyone to bear word to Burrick or Molly that someone was looking for them. Months had passed in my journeying. In every village I passed, I saw signs of new graves. Whatever the sickness had been, it had spread wide and taken many with it. In none of my visions had I seen Nettle. Had it carried her off as well? I spiraled out from Capelin Beach, visiting inns and taverns in nearby villages. I became a slightly daft traveller, obsessed with beekeeping and professing to know all there was to know on the topic. I started arguments so others would correct me and speak of beekeepers they had known. Yet all my efforts to hear the slightest rumour of Molly were fruitless, until late one afternoon I followed a narrow road to the crest of the hill, and suddenly recognized a stand of oak trees. All my courage vanished in that instant. I left the road and skulked through the forested hills that flanked it. The wolf came with me, unquestioning, not even letting his thoughts intrude on mine as I stalked my old life. By early evening we were on a hillside looking down on their cottage. It was a tidy and prosperous stead, with chickens scratching in the side yard and three straw hives in the meadow behind it. There was a well-tended vegetable garden. Behind the cottage were a barn, obviously a newer structure, and several small paddocks built of skinned logs. I smelled horse. Burrick had done well for them. I sat in the dark and watched the single window glow yellow with candlelight and then wink to blackness. The wolf hunted alone that night as I kept my vigil. I could not approach, and I could not leave. I was caught where I was, a leaf on the edge of their eddy. I suddenly understood all the legends of ghosts doomed to forever haunt some spot. No matter how far I roamed, some part of me would always be chained here. As dawn broke, Burrick emerged from the cottage door. His limp was more pronounced than I recalled it, as was the streak of white in his hair. He lifted his face to the dawning day and took a great breath, and for one wolfish instant I feared he would scent me there. But he only walked to the well and drew up a bucket of water. He carried it inside, then returned a moment later to throw some grain to the chickens. The smoke of an awakened fire rose from the chimney. So, Molly was up and about also. Burrick went out to the barn. As clear as if I were walking beside him, I knew his routine. After he had checked every animal, he would come outside. He did, and drew water, carrying bucket after bucket into the barn. My words choked me for an instant. Then I laughed aloud. My eyes swam with tears, but I ignored them. I swear, fool, that is when I came closest to going down to him. It seemed as unnatural a thing as I had ever done, to watch Burrick work and not toil alongside him. The fool nodded, silent and rapt beside me. When he came out, he was leading a roan stallion. It astonished me. "Book keeps best," shouted every line of his body. His spirit was in the arch of his neck, his power in his shoulders and haunches. My heart swelled in me just to see such a horse, and to know he was in Burrick's keeping rejoiced me. He turned the horse loose in a paddock, and then hauled yet more water to the trough there. When he next led Ruddy out, much of the mystery was cleared for me. I did not know then that Starling had hunted him down and seen to it that both his horse and Sooty's colt were given over to him. It was just good to see man and horse together again. Ruddy looked to have settled into good-natured stability. Even so, Burrick did not paddock him next to the other stud, but put him as far away as possible. He hauled more water for Ruddy, then gave him a friendly thump and went back into the cottage. Then Molly came out. I took another breath and held it. I stared out at the ocean, but that was not what I saw. The image of she who had been my woman moved before my eyes. Her dark hair, once wild and blowing to the wind, was braided and pinned sedately to her head, a matron's crown. A little boy toddled unsteadily after her. Basket on her arm, she moved with placid grace towards the garden. Her white apron draped her swelling pregnancy. The swift and slender girl was gone, but I found this woman no less attractive. My heart yearned after her and all she represented, the cozy hearth and the settled home, the companionship of the years to come as she filled her man's home with children and warmth. I whispered her name. It was so strange. She lifted her head suddenly, and for one sharp moment I thought she was aware of me. But instead of looking up to the hill, she laughed aloud and exclaimed, "Chivalry, no, not good to eat." She stooped slightly to pull a handful of pea flowers from the child's mouth. She lifted him, and I saw the effort it cost her. She called back to the cottage. "My love, come fetch your son before he pulls the whole garden up. Tell Nettle to come and pull some turnips for me." Then I heard Burrick call back, "A moment." An instant later, he stood in the doorway. He called over his shoulder, "We'll finish the washing up later. Come help your mother." I watched him cross the yard in a few strides and snatch up his son. He swung him high, and the child gave a whoop of delight as Burrick landed him on his shoulder. Molly set a hand upon her belly and laughed with them, looking up at them both with delight in her eyes. I stopped speaking. I could no longer see the ocean. Tears blinded me like a fog. I felt the fool's hand on my shoulder. "You never went down to them, did you?" I shook my head mutely. I had fled. I had fled the sudden gnawing envy I felt, and I fled lest I glimpse my own child and have to go to her. There was no place down there for me, not even on the edges of their world. I knew that. I had known it since first I knew they would marry. If I walked down to that door, I would carry destruction and misery with me. I am no better than any other man. There was bitterness in me, and anger at both of them, and the stark loneliness of how fate had betrayed us all. I could not blame them for turning to each other. Neither did I blame myself for the anguish I felt that by that act they had excluded me forever from their lives. It was done and over, and regrets were useless. The dead, I told myself, have no rights to regret. The most I can claim for myself is that I did walk away. I did not let my pain poison their happiness or compromise my daughter's home. That much strength I found. I drew a long breath and found my voice again. "And that is the end of my tale, fool. Next winter caught us here. We found this hut and settled into it, and here we have been ever since." I blew out a breath and thought over my own words. Suddenly none of it seemed admirable. His next words rattled me. "And your other child?" he asked quietly. "What?" "Dutiful. Have you seen him? Is not he your son just as much as Nettle is your daughter?" No, he is not. And I have never seen him. He is Catrican's son and Verity's heir, so Catrican recalls it, I am sure." I felt myself reddening, embarrassed that the fool had brought this up. I set my hand to his shoulder. "My friend, only you and I know of how Verity used me. My body. When he asked my permission, I misunderstood his request. I myself have no memory of how Dutiful was conceived. You must recall I was with you, trapped in Verity's misused flesh. My king did what he did to get himself an heir. I do not begrudge it, but neither do I wish to remember it.